speak about something, we'll give a few answers that others give, and then I'll tell you what I think. And that is the following. When Moshe Rabbeinu, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, told him that he's going to redeem the Jewish people, and he's going to take them to Eretz Yisrael, and that was the plan. But he was told to tell Paro, Derech Shloshes Yomim Bamidbar Neilech V'Nizbechol Hashem Elokeinu. We want to go 3 days in the desert to make sacrifices to God. That was exactly what Paro was told, and that's what they were negotiating the whole time. 3 days in the desert. Paro kept saying, okay, leave your children here, leave your animals here, but I want to make sure you're coming back. Right? But all Moshe was asking for was 3 days in the desert to make sacrifices. That was a lie. How did the Rav Elmishlam tell Moshe Rabbeinu to lie to Paro instead of telling him that they're going out for good? What was this idea of telling him we're going to go 3 days in the desert? So there are many answers to that question. One answer is the Or HaChaim HaKadosh and the Ramban. Combine the two, each one says another prat. And that's the following. The Rabban Hashem wanted to punish Paro, Mida Keneged Mida. Okay. And he wanted, therefore, to get him to the Yamsuf so he could drown him. Because they drowned our children, that was the ultimate of what they did to us. And therefore, they had to be drowned. In order to drown them, the Ribbono Shel Olam had to get them somehow to the Yam Suf. So he created this facade that we're leaving for 3 days. And when Paro saw that we weren't coming back, that gave him the incentive to chase after us. And he chased after us till the Yam Suf, and then he was drowned. So in order to drown Paro, HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to create this lie that we're coming back in 3 days to give Paro the incentive to chase after us. That's the Ramban. On the surface, very difficult, because the Ramban Shem couldn't figure out another way to drown the Mitzrayim without lying to them. Mitzvah Sheker Tirchok, the Ramban Shem is the epitome of emes. So we'll add the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, put the two together, and makes more it's more understandable. The Rachaim says that part of the punishment, Mida Keneged Mida, was also the following. Paro did not come and enslave the Jewish people outright. But he did it, like Chazal say, Beperach. He fooled us. And the Medrash says all different ways that he did that. Most famous, that he said that Egypt needs cities, store cities built, and they need patriots to volunteer to build these cities. And he said, I'm going to come and build them myself. Anybody who wants to join, and Jews usually are bigger patriots than the Goyim. They want to be better Egyptians than the Egyptians. So the Jews showed up to build these cities. And in the beginning, Paro even paid them. And then he said, look, we don't have any more money to pay. You have to do it voluntarily. So they came and they volunteered. And then as they got into the rut of working every day like that, all of a sudden they saw that their taskmasters behind them were telling them that they have to produce what they produced the day before. So Paro fooled them into becoming slaves. And therefore, not only did the Jews suffer because they were slaves, they also suffered psychologically that they were had. They were made to be like fools. They were fooled. When a person is fooled, it makes him feel very, very bad. You feel like a fool. So therefore, when the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted to punish Paro, Mida Keneged Mida, he couldn't just drown him, because that would only take care of one aspect of what he did. But in order to take out the aspect that he made the Jewish people feel like fools, he had to be made to feel like a fool. So Bedafka, the Ribbono Shel Olam told Moshe to tell him we're coming back, and then he saw that he was also had, and he was made into a fool, and they're not coming back, so he chased after us because he felt now what the Jews felt when they felt like a fool. And then the Ribbono Shel Olam used that ploy to drown him and finish off the Mida Keneged Mida. That is more or less the the Ramban and the Or HaChaim. And therefore, it never really happened. It was all made up, but there was a purpose for it, in order to punish Paro, Mida Keneged Mida, both in getting him to the Yamsuf to drown him, and doing it in a way that made him feel like a fool. Both of those things he did to Klal Yisrael. Okay, then there is the Svarno. Almost just the opposite. There's a machlokus, I think we mentioned it last week, of why the Rabban Shem hardened Paro's heart. What was the purpose? The Rambam says it was to punish him, take away his free choice, in order to use him as a pawn to punish him and to teach the world a lesson. Paro already was liable to be killed, and if God would have killed him, he would have taken away his free choice. Instead of killing him, he took away his free choice and used him as a pawn to teach the world a lesson. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu took away Paro's free choice by hardening his heart. That's the Rambam. The Ramban, the Svarno, say differently. They say that the Ribono Shel Olam wanted Paro to choose to let the Jewish people go, not to be forced. And the Makos would have forced anybody to agree and to comply. So the Ribono Shel Olam hardened Paro's heart to even the playing field, to make it that now he has free choice. Had he not hardened his heart, he would have taken away his free choice, because he would have had to say yes, because of the Gvuras HaMakos. But now that his heart was hardened, the Makos would not force him to say yes. Now he still had choice. He could say yes or no. Now it's his own choice. So the purpose of hardening Paro's heart was to give him free choice, not to take it away. According to that idea, then you can understand also why the Ribono Shel Olam came to him and said, 3 days in the desert. Because if the Ribono Shel Olam had come to Paro and said, look, I want you to let all your slaves go forever, finished, Paro could not have said yes. It was something beyond his capability. Right? Let all my slaves go. So therefore the Ribono Shel Olam negotiated with him. Okay, we're not going for good. We only want to go for 3 days. We'll come back. That Paro could conceivably agree to. Once he would agree to that, then mitzvah goreres mitzvah. You agree to one thing with the Ribono Shel Olam, that's how negotiations go. You agree a little bit, then a little bit more, right? Give us Aza, then give us this and that. And that's the way that the negotiations go in the world. So we give into this, and then, okay, now we'll negotiate. How about, we'll stay 3 months? How about 3 years? And then, so little by little, Paro would get into the understanding that this is going to be forever, but it would happen gradually, and that way he'd be able to choose to do it. Had he come to him all at once, said, all your slaves go now, he could never have said yes. So God wanted him to have free choice, according to the Ramban and the Svarno. So this was also part of the idea of maintaining his free choice. It's another pshat. A third pshat is Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, based on a vort of the Rabbi Yonason Apshitz. He says like this. He says that originally the Jewish people were supposed to be in Egypt for 400 years. They were only in Egypt for 210 years. But the Ribono Shel Olam saw that after 210 years, a good portion of Klal Yisrael had assimilated, had reached the Memtesh Shari Tuma, and if he left them there any longer, right, they would be lost completely. There'd be nobody to redeem. So therefore the Ribono Shel Olam said the following. If Paro will allow you to go, okay, the contingent on that, then I want you to go 3 days in the desert for a Shabbaton of Chizuk. You're going to come back. That was true. You're going to come back and what's it called, and serve the other 190 years. But you need a chizuk that you'll be able to come back, and what's it called, and survive in Mitzrayim. So I want you to go out in the desert for 3 days with Moshe and Aaron. You'll have all these, you know, a lot of ruach and dancing and a nice havdalah service or whatever, and you'll really give you chizuk, and then you go back to Mitzrayim, and that will give you the ability to survive for another 190 years. That was plan A. And it was true. Had Paro agreed to let them go, they would have gone and come back and spent another 190 years in Mitzrayim. But because Paro didn't let them go, and he made the work harder, so the Rabbanu Shlom took them out, then 190 years early. But originally, if Paro agreed, they would have gone for 3 days, had chizuk, and come back. He says the same thing happened 2 other times in history. One, by Bayesheni. Really, we were supposed to be in Gaulus till Mashiach comes. We weren't supposed to be redeemed from Gaulus Bavel. That Gaulus was supposed to be till Mashiach would come, whenever that is. However, the Rabbanu Shlom saw that after 70 years in Bavel, they had degenerated so much that there wasn't going to be anything to save. They forgot already Lashon HaKodesh, and they were mamish at the lowest level in Bavel. So the Rabbanu Shlom said they need a shot in the arm to be able to go back into Gaulus till Mashiach comes. Because otherwise they're going to be lost completely. So he took them out of Bavel. It wasn't the Geula. It was called the Pekida. That's why many of the Gedolim didn't come back. Because it wasn't for them. It was basically for the people who were weak. Most of them had married Goyim. That's what Ezra did. Separated from their Goyish spouses. And they made a lot of takanas during Bayesheni in order to separate from the Goyim. That's when they made the Isser of Bishul Akum and Yein, Stam Yeinom and so on. So they'd be able to go back into Gaulus by the Romans and remain till Mashiach comes. But had they not had that 420 years of Bayesheni, they would have been lost completely. So the Rabbanu Shlom gave them a shot in the arm. Brought them back to Eretz Yisrael for 420 years, and specifically the weaker ones, in order to strengthen them. That was the second time in history that that happened, right? Really, they should have stayed in Gaulus till Mashiach came, but the Rabbanu Shlom took them out of Gaulus for 420 years to give them a shot in the arm that they'd be able to survive till Mashiach comes. And the third time, says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, this was the Rabbi Yonason Apeshitz. The third time was in our times. After the Holocaust, many, many Jews wanted to give up. They didn't want to admit they're Jewish. They just wanted to totally divest themselves of what they saw happens if you're Jewish. And the Rabbanu Shlom said, if I don't do something, especially for the weaker ones, there's not going to be a nation to redeem when Mashiach comes. So he gave us back Eretz Yisrael, Medinas Yisrael, and that, up until the Yom Kippur War, at least, was a tremendous boost for mainly for the Jews who weren't frum. Because Jews who were frum had frumkeit to give them something of identity of Judaism. But the ones who weren't frum, right, were easily to assimilate and just forget about being Jewish because look at the tsaris, the Jews being Jews caused. But once they got the state of Israel, right, they were proud of being Jews again. Now, we have our own country and our own army or whatever, and it gave them a pride that Lamaisa, for the weaker people, and not necessarily the frum ones even, Eretz Yisrael or Medinas Yisrael served that purpose. So that's the second time in history, the third time in history, where the Rabbanu Shel Olam needed to give us a chizuk. Because if we wouldn't get the chizuk, we wouldn't have lasted until the actual Geula would come. It happened in Mitzrayim, that originally the 3 days, and in Mitzrayim, since you had Moshe and Aaron, 3 days was enough. By Yesheni, you needed 420 years to give you that chizuk. And here, whatever time it is that we have, Eretz Yisrael gives the chizuk to people who wouldn't have that chizuk without it, keeps them going with a Jewish identity till Mashiach will come. That is Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. All of these answers, okay, basically, it never happened. Either it was a lie to begin with, but in order to punish Paro. It was a lie to begin with to give Paro the ability to make a free choice. Or it was supposed to be, but it didn't actually happen. I want to tell you, a teretz, that is exactly what happened. It wasn't a lie. It was 100% true, and that's exactly what happened. They went 3 days in the desert and made sacrifices. Now, you ask me, where do we find this? In order to understand that, I want to say the following. We do not redeem ourselves. Okay, even though the song for Hanukkah says, right, in every generation, Jews have to arise and redeem themselves, no such thing. We don't redeem ourselves, we make a bracha, two brachas, go El Yisrael, the Rabbanu Shalom is the Redeemer. We do not redeem ourselves from anything. What do? We prepare ourselves for redemption. We show the Rabbanu Shalom that we are fit to be redeemed. That's our part. Okay, that's why, I think, when do we celebrate Seder Pesach? Basically, till Chatzos, right? Till Chatzos. When did we actually go out of Egypt? In the morning. When did we have the right to go out? After Chatzos, after Makas Bechoros. Did we go out of Egypt before Chatzos? No. In fact, there's an argument the whole year amongst Chazal whether there's a mitzvah to remember Yetzias Mitzrayim at night. We say it in the Haggadah, right? Right? Lo zachisi sheteyomer Yetzias Mitzrayim balelos, ad shedrasha ben zoma, right? Leman tizkeres yom seisro meretzrayim, kol yemei chayecho hayomim, kol yemei chayecho halelos. Okay? What is the argument? So they explain, the argument is that we didn't go out of Mitzrayim at night. We went out of Mitzrayim in the daytime, in the morning. Paro said, get out at Chatzos. But Moshe said, we're not leaving here like Ganovim. We'll wait till the morning and leave like mentioned. So they didn't actually go out till the morning. So the opinion that says that you don't remember Yetzias Mitzrayim at night is because it didn't happen at night. It happened in the daytime. I have the opinion that says you do, because Lemaisa, potentially, we had the ability to leave at Chatzos at night. So therefore, we remember Yetzias Mitzrayim at night too, because potentially we could have left after Chatzos, but we chose not to. Okay. But before Chatzos, there's absolutely no idea of Geula. So why in the world do we celebrate Pesach Dafka before Chatzos? All the mitzvahs have to be finished by Chatzos. Why? There wasn't the time of the Geula. The answer is, we're not celebrating what God did. Let Him celebrate that. God took us out of Mitzrayim. We have a mitzvah to remember what God did. But what we celebrate is reliving Yetzias Mitzrayim. What was our part in Yetzias Mitzrayim? Being fit to be redeemed. So we had to eat matzah and make Korban Pesach and Maror, right? And take the lamb, and all of those things showed the Rabbanu Shalom we were fit to be redeemed. So we don't relive what God did. We relive what we did. What we did was before Chatzos, doing all those mitzvahs that gave us the ability, that made us fit to be redeemed. But ultimately, the Rabbanu Shalom redeemed us. We don't celebrate redemption, we celebrate what we did to be redeemed. So, we are the ones who prepare ourselves for redemption, but we don't redeem ourselves. Therefore, the Rabbanu Shalom said like this, you don't have to go and ask Paro for permission for me to redeem you. That's my business. And Paro, I don't need Paro's permission to redeem you. So you don't have to go to Paro and say, we want to leave and go to Eretz Yisrael. I want to take Eretz Yisrael. I'll take Eretz Yisrael whether Paro likes it or not. However, you have your part to do. I want you to prove to me that you are fit to be redeemed. For that, I want you to go 3 days in the desert and make sacrifices. And if you do that, and you show me that you are fit to be redeemed, then I will take you and take you to Eretz Yisrael and redeem you for good. My part, you don't have to ask Paro about, but you're his slaves. Your part, you have to ask him permission. You want permission to go 3 days in the desert and make sacrifices? That's your part in the Geula, proving to me that you're fit. You are Paro's slaves. It's only right to ask him permission to do your part. My part is, if you show me that you're fit, I'll take you to Eretz Yisrael and redeem you for good. I don't have to ask Paro permission to do my part. You have to ask him to do your part. Okay. So, still, where in the world did they go 3 days and make sacrifices? What does that mean? In order to understand that, you have to understand the following. Chazal say in Pirkei Avos, Ein lecha ben chorin ela mi she'osik batorah. Real freedom is a person who is totally immersed in Torah. Observing the Torah, learning the Torah, that's freedom. Now on the surface, that does not make any sense. Torah is great, it's eternally rewarding, but it's freedom? It's lechora, the opposite of freedom, right? Right? If you ask, we in the vernacular, irreligious Jews are called freie Yidden, free Jews. Why? Because they do anything they want. They can dress as they want. They can eat what they want. They can work when they want. They can think what they want. They can say what they want. And religious Jews have to think what the Rabbanu Shem tells you to think, say what the Rabbanu Shem tells you to say, dress the way the Rabbanu Shem wants you to dress, work when he says to work, eat this, don't eat that. We're free. It's nice, but what, that's called freedom. Ein lecha ben chorek, the only really free person is a person who's immersed in Torah. What kind of freedom is that? So there are many answers, but the answer that I like to give is the following. The Gemara says that deep down inside, every Jew wants to do Ratzon Hashem. It says, Ritzoneinu lasos ritzonecho. Deep down, your neshama is screaming, I want to do Ratzon Hashem. There's a portion of every one of our neshamas, and it applies to every Jew, irregardless of where they're holding, how frum they are, whatever. There's a portion of a Jewish neshama that can never be corrupted, that always wants to do Ratzon Hashem. You can't possibly defile, corrupt, be metame that part of your neshama. It's a portion of the neshama, which is, the Sfas Emes calls it, the portion of Mogin Avram. It's the Pintali Yid, they say in Yiddish. It's that spark of Yiddish that never is extinguished. It's there, pure, always. So, then Magmares, that's the case, then why don't we do Ratzon Hashem many times? Mama Akev, Seor Shebi'isa, the Yetzer Hara, the Shibud Malchios, and the fact that sometimes outside forces prevent us, Goyim, prevent us from keeping the Torah. Or they from inside the Yetzer Hara. I always like to explain, Shibud Malchios does not necessarily mean Goyim who force us not to keep the Torah. But there's two kinds of Yetzer Haras. There's the inner Yetzer Hara of normal desires that a person uses the wrong way. Eating. There's a normal desire to eat. People have a Yetzer Hara to eat treif. So that's a normal desire, right? You're just distorting a normal desire. But then there are things that no person is born with that normal desire. Those desires come from the outside. For instance, there is no normal desire that a person is born with to buy faded blue jeans that are torn and spend $200. Right? There's no Yetzer Hara in the world to do that. It's from the inside. So what makes you do it? Why are there people who buy $200 blue jeans that are faded and torn, which you can get for free from the Salvation Army? Right? What gives a person the desire to do that? The answer is cultural influence. It's because it's a fad, because that's the thing people do. So it's not a Yetzer Hara that comes from within, it's a Yetzer Hara that comes from Shibud Malchios, by being subjugated to the culture around you. So those are the two things that prevent a person from doing Ratzon Hashem, to the point where really your inner desire, what you know is good for you, is to do Ratzon Hashem. That's what you really want to do. The Yetzer Hara then superimposes other desires, and you begin to think you want to do something else. But deep down, your neshama is screaming, no, I want to do Ratzon Hashem. But it's muffled by other desires. This is not just a nice idea, it's a halachic idea. Because the halacha is the following. I'll give you an example. Halacha is that a man, in order to divorce his wife, has to do it willingly. If he's forced to divorce her, it's no divorce. It's nachal. Okay? With certain exceptions, which we'll get to in a second. Meaning the following. If a man does not want to divorce his wife, and you hire a goy to come, right, and tell him, if you don't divorce your wife, we're going to break your kneecaps. Right? So, maybe you want to divorce her. He says, no, I don't want to divorce her, but I really want to keep my kneecaps. So, you know, I'm going to divorce her because you want to break my knees if I don't. If he writes a get, the Adam sign it, it is worthless. It's like a piece of comic book. It's not a get. One of the conditions is it has to be written with the consent of the husband. If he's forced to do it, it's not a get. However, In the following case, it is, even if he's forced. What happens? Mr. Cohen marries a divorcee, which he's not allowed to do. He's a Cohen. And in the time when Beis Din had the power, they would call Mr. Cohen in and say, we understand you married a divorcee, and she's married, and she needs a get. And he's not allowed to live with her, but the marriage is a marriage. So we want him to divorce her. So we call him into Beis Din, and we say, Mr. Cohen, maybe you're not aware that a Cohen's not allowed to marry a divorcee, but you did. We'd like you to divorce her. He says, no, I love my wife. I don't want to divorce her. I don't really care if a Cohen's not allowed to marry a divorcee. That doesn't bother me. So we tell him, well, it bothers us, and it really pollutes the world, so we'd like you to divorce her. Okay? He says, well, I'm not going to. He says, okay, grab him. They grab him, tie him up to a pole, and they call in the Shliach Beis Din with a whip. And they say, Mr. Cohen, we would like you to divorce your wife. He says, but I really don't want to. He says, okay, hit him. They start beating him. They say, Mr. Cohen, have you recanted? Maybe you would like to divorce your wife? He says, no. They beat him up more. Till he's almost bloody, right? And a little bit from now, he's not going to have to divorce his wife because she'll be an almona, right? She'll be a widow in a little while. So they look at him. He's on the ground, bleeding profusely. The guy's holding the whip over him. And he says, Mr. Cohen, maybe you change your mind. Maybe you'd like to divorce your wife. He says, you know what? I think maybe I'd like to divorce my wife. He says, fine. Tell the sofer to write the get. Tell the edim to sign it. Does it. They write it. He signs it. He gives it to her. Mazel tov. It's a good divorce. Who are we fooling? He said he doesn't want to do it. What does he want? Stop beating me. So he's been coerced into writing this get. Why is it okay? Says the Rambam, based on the Gemara, because deep down inside, when Mr. Cohen came to Beis Din, he wanted to divorce his wife. Except he didn't know it. Because his neshama was screaming, I don't want to be over this iser. Except the Yetzer Hara superimposed other desires. So when we beat him, we're not changing his mind. We are freeing his inner desire to come to the surface. We're beating away all the Yetzer Haras that impede his desire that's buried within him to come to the surface. If we'd have to change his mind, you can't force somebody to change their mind. Then you're forcing them. But if we're not changing his mind, we're just releasing that inner will, which wasn't expressed because it's buried under other wills. We're beating away all the other wills and letting his real will come to the surface. That's fine. We didn't change anything. We just released, we freed his inner will. Therefore, since everybody deep down inside wants to do Ratzon Hashem, and his neshama is screaming, I want to do Ratzon Hashem, and the Yetzer Hara enslaves us to do other things. I'll give you an example of what it's like. Doesn't apply, I imagine, to anybody here, including myself. That's why I like to give this example, because I don't like to give examples that apply to me. Somebody who smokes, okay? If you catch them in a lucid moment, any normal person, and say to them, do you really want to smoke cigarettes? Don't you realize how dangerous it is? You're destroying your lungs. You're taking a chance of getting terrible diseases. It says that on the packet, right? So any normal person, intelligent person, would say, no, I really would love to stop smoking. I can't. It's just too enjoyable. I'm addicted to it. I can't stop. You know what that person is? He's a slave. Because deep down, he knows that it's good for him not to smoke. But he can't control himself. So imagine the cigarette with two little legs, like the planter's peanut guy, right, with maybe a monocle and a whip in his hand. And the cigarette, right, the guy says deep down inside, I don't want to smoke. And the cigarette says, you're going to smoke me whether you like it or not. So he's a slave to a cigarette. The same thing goes with every Aveira. We are slaves to the Yetzer Hara because we really don't want to do that. And deep down, our neshama is screaming that we don't want to do it. So real freedom is being able to do what you really want to do and not what the Yetzer Hara enslaves you to do against your better will, which is what's deep down in your neshama. You may not ever hear it, but it's there. That's real freedom. Real freedom is being a slave to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And that answers another question that always bothered me. How we start the Seder with Holachma Anya Diachalu Avasana Ba'arad Mitzrayim. This is the bread of slavery. Okay? Matzah represents the bread of slavery. Represents slavery. Why? Says the Ibn Ezra. L'chara, we ate matzah when we left Mitzrayim, not in Mitzrayim. Says the Ibn Ezra, no. The whole 400 years, the whole 210 years of Mitzrayim, what did they feed us? Matzah. Paro fed us matzah. Matzah was the food of slaves. Why? Because it's relatively cheap. Because it's just, what's it called? Flour and water. There's no other additives. It's made very quickly, so there's no labor, extra labor cost, because it's done quickly. And it doesn't digest quickly. So you don't want to eat a lot of it. It lays in your stomach. I'm sure the matzah from last Pesach is still in my stomach. So it lays in your stomach. So it's an ideal food to feed slaves. Something has changed over the years. And now matzah is called lechem only because that's what you are after you buy it. But lemaisa, in those days, it was slave food. The Ibn Ezra says in his time in Spain, that's what they fed prisoners. Matzah. It was an economic food to feed prisoners. So matzah is the symbol of slavery. We start the Seder, Holach Ma'anyo, this is the bread that our ancestors ate in Egypt, the bread of slaves. How do we end the Seder? What do we eat? The last thing we eat is what? Afikomen, which is matzah. Why? Because matzah is the symbol of freedom. We left Mitzrayim post-haste. There was no time to make bread. And the matzah is a symbol of freedom. I don't know, if you asked me to design a Seder, I wouldn't do it like that. I would start with matzah, the symbol of slavery. And I would end with 7-layer strawberry shortcake. That's a symbol of freedom. That's how you end the Seder. But to start the Seder with matzah, and that's a symbol of slavery, and end the Seder with matzah, that's a symbol of freedom, doesn't make sense. Now, the answer is, people think that at the end of the Seder, we're free. No, we're not free. We're still slaves. That didn't change. We were slaves at the beginning of the Seder and we're slaves at the end of the Seder. You know what changed? Who we're slaves to. In the beginning of the Seder, we're slaves to Paro. And the matzah is a symbol of slavery. But the matzah is still a symbol of slavery, but at the end of the Seder, we're eating the matzah because we're slaves to God. And that's the ultimate freedom. But we're still slaves. We didn't stop being slaves. And the Gemara says that. Meikara avdei de paro, vahashta avdei dacha kodesh baruch hu. In the beginning we're slaves to paro, now we're slaves to God. But being slaves to God is the ultimate freedom, like we explained. When you're totally submitted to God, you're doing exactly what you know is good for you. So you're free. You're free to do what you really want to do. So we start eating like slaves and we end. And send. And the Shalom HaKadosh says, that's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us Eretz Yisrael. Because Eretz Yisrael is the land of slaves. Eretz Canaan. It's a good place for slaves to be. We're slaves to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's why we were slaves in Egypt, to learn how to be a slave. But being a slave to Hashem is the ultimate freedom. Memela, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to test us. Do we understand that freedom is not just doing whatever you want? Freedom is being subjugated to God. And therefore the Rabban Shem said the following. I want you to go 3 days in the desert and make sacrifices. Now we didn't know what the sacrifices were. Even Moshe didn't know. Moshe told Paro, we have to take all our cattle with us because God didn't tell me what sacrifices to make. And who knows how many animals we need and what kind of animals. We have to take it all with us. So even Moshe Rabbeinu did not know what God meant when he said to make sacrifices. Okay? Now let me tell you what happened. And this is actually exactly what happened. Like I told you, the Rabbanu Shlom said, I want you to ask to go 3 days in the desert and make sacrifices. That's your part in the Geula. My part in the Geula, I don't have to tell Paro. I don't have to ask his permission. I do what I want. But your part, you have to ask him permission. You're his slaves. What was our part? To go 3 days in the desert and make sacrifices. What happened 3 days in the desert? We left Mitzrayim on Thursday. That was Yetzias Mitzrayim, Thursday morning. We traveled Thursday, Friday. Shabbos was the third day in the desert. What happened on Shabbos? That is Shabbos Chol HaMoed Pesach. What happened that first Shabbos Chol HaMoed? The Rabbanu Shel Olam told Moshe Rabbeinu, go back. Tell the Jewish people to go back to Mitzrayim. The Yashuvu v'yachinu lifnei piachiros. They didn't know why. They thought they're going back to Egypt. What was the most important, precious thing the Jewish people had at that moment? Freedom. They were free. They had 3 days to get a chazakah, to get used to it, to being free. And all of a sudden, the Rabban Shalom says, I want you to go back to Egypt. If the Jewish people said, nothing doing, Rabban Shalom asks us for anything else, we are not giving up our freedom and going back to Egypt, then they would have not understood what freedom is. They would think freedom is doing whatever you want, what's good for you, not being mishubed, subjugated to Hashem. And then they wouldn't have been fit to be redeemed. But if they'd be willing to go back and say, Rabbanu Shel Olam, if you want us to give up our freedom for you, then we understand that's the ultimate freedom, we're willing to go back, then they deserved. What was that? 3 days in the desert and making a sacrifice. Not animal sacrifices, the ultimate sacrifice. Sacrificing their freedom. If you're going to be able to go in the desert for 3 days and make sacrifices, and they didn't know what it was, now they know what it was. Sacrifice your freedom. Then you understand what freedom is. It's being a slave to Hashem, and then you deserve to be redeemed. If you're not willing to do that, then you don't deserve to be redeemed. Ultimately, the Jewish people as a people agreed to go back, and what's it called? And they only started complaining when they found themselves stuck by the Yam, and didn't know what to do, and the Egyptians are running after them. So then they were at Tsoras. But they, as a people, agreed to go back. They didn't know that it was only a ploy. They thought that that's it. We went 3 days, now we're going back. And they were willing to listen to the Ribbono Shel Olam and sacrifice their freedom to do Ratzon Hashem. Then it means that they understood what freedom is. And therefore they're fit to be redeemed. So it's exactly what happened. The Ribbono Shel Olam said, I want you to tell Paro you want permission to go 3 days in the desert and make sacrifices. The Ribbono Shel Olam's intention was they'll go 3 days and then he's going to ask them to sacrifice their freedom and see. I, the Ribbono Shel Olam, told Moshe we're going out for good. That's my part of the Geulah, says the Ribbono Shel Olam. I don't have to tell Paro about that. I don't have to ask his permission. If I want to take him out, I'll take him out. But I want you to ask permission for your part of the Geulah. Your part is being fit to be Nigal. The test will be, will you go 3 days in the desert and make sacrifices? And that's, in the end, what this sacrifice was. And that proved that they were fit. That's all they had to tell Paro. That's what I think it means. Okay. Let's go to something else here. The says in the Shira, try to pick one or two shorter things because we don't have time for something long here. The other things maybe we'll speak about by Pesach time. But in any case, it says in the Shira, Ashira Hashem ki go go. I want to sing to the Ribbono Shel Olam because he really did really tremendous things. What were the tremendous things? Sus v'roch v'roma v'yom. The horse and the rider both were thrown into the sea at the same time. Now that's really something special, amazing, right? Because usually, if the horse gets thrown into the sea, the rider falls off. But here, the Ribbono Shel Olam made the rider and the horse fall into the sea together. Now that's really something special. Now let me ask you, if you saw Kriyas Yam Suf, saw the sea split, what would you be impressed with? All the most thing, that what, the rider didn't fall off the horse? That is really the most impressive thing about Kriyas Yam Suf. I mean, a little super glue could do the same thing. What is that? That's not the major miracle of Kriyas Yam Suf. And not only did Moshe emphasize that, when Miriam sang the same thing. Shiru Lashem ki go go sus v'roch v'rom avayom. The horse and the rider together. Right? That really impressed them. Make any sense? Do you ever think about this? Right? What in the world? That is the epitome of Kriyas Yam Suf. The sea split, they were drowned. No, but the rider didn't fall off the horse. Now that's really something special. What in the world's going on? So what I think it means is the following. The Svarim say, the Nefesh HaChaim and others, that everything in this world is either a horse or a rider. Meaning the following. Everything under the Ribbono Shel Olam is a cause or an effect. Right, you have the what's it called, the rochev, who's riding the horse and moving the horse underneath. So you have all different kinds of kochos. The Rav Shem created a world where there are causes and effects. There's malachim that make every blade of grass grow. So the malach is the rider, and the grass is the horse. It's the effect. It's what the rider, the causer, causes that effect. But it works down in a chain. In other words, there's a cause to an effect, but that effect makes another cause. So it is the rider to the thing underneath it, which is the horse. And that horse is a rider to the thing underneath that, which is the horse for that. Everything goes in a hishtalshulus of a chain of causes and effects. This thing causes this. But that, so in that legabe that, A is the cause to B, right? So A is the rider and B is the horse. But now B causes C. So in that relationship, B is the rider and C is the horse. And all the way down the chain, right, there are causes and effects, and those effects make other causes, and it all emanates from the Ribbono Shel Olam. So the Ribbono Shel Olam is the ultimate rider. That's why the Ribbono Shel Olam is called Rochev Shamayim Be'ezrecha. The Ribbono Shel Olam rides the heavens. What does that mean? It means that he is the cause of everything. All the secondary causes are themselves riders, but they're also horses, because they're being caused by something else. Only the Ribbono Shel Olam is the ultimate rider, because, what's it called, he doesn't have anything on him. He is the cause of everything. So the Ribbono Shel Olam is called Rochev Shamayim Be'ezrecha. What they saw by Kriyas Yam Suf is that all the things in this world that seem to be causes are really in themselves effects. They're being caused by something else. And there's no difference between the horse and the rider. They're all the same. They're one entity. Don't think that there are causes in this world, right, that are independent causes. No, it only looks like that. But they are no different than the horse. The rider and the horse become one. And when you understand that, that was Kriyas Yam Suf. Kriyas Yam Suf is, there are no independent forces in this world. Everything is a result of the Ribbono Shel Olam's force. He is the only rider. Everything else is a horse. And therefore the rider and the horse are one. Don't give credit to the rider. The rider is just the same thing as the horse. Sus v'roch v'rom avayom. That was the lesson of Kriyas Yam Suf. That's exactly what they learned. They learned that there are no forces in this world, right? Nothing. Not money, not power, not political power, not anything that is an independent force. There are no riders. The riders and the horses are the same. The only rider really is the Ribbono Shel Olam. He's Rochev Shamayim. So that epitomizes what they learned from Kriyas Yam Suf. That's what I think. I'm sure there must be other pshatim. I haven't seen any. And this, it doesn't make any sense. So again, why in the world emphasize that idea that the horses and the rider didn't fall apart? Like, that does not seem to be the most impressive thing about Kriyas Yam Suf. Okay. What else? Okay, one last thing. It says before Oz Yashir, Vayiru Ha'omes Hashem, Vayaminu Bashem of Moshe Avdo. Anything wrong with that pasuk? They feared God and they believed in God and in Moshe, that Moshe was God's servant. Okay. Anything wrong with the pasuk? Which comes first? Fearing God or believing in God? If you don't believe in God, you can't fear Him. Oh, I fear God, but I don't believe in Him. It's absurd, right? First you have to believe that there's a God. Then you can go to the next madrega of fearing God, or standing in awe of Him, being awestruck with God. You can't be awestruck with a God you don't believe in. So it should have said Vayaminu Bashem Moshe Avdo, and then Vayiru es Hashem. Why does it say Vayiru and then Vayaminu? So to make a long story short, Emuna does not mean that I believe, and if you cross the line, either you're a non-believer or you're a believer. Emuna has in it a lot of components. Emuna starts when you believe in God. But that's not what real emunah is. Emunah is, I believe it, and I really believe it. There's a very big difference between believing something and really, really feeling it. Because you can believe in God, but, you know, if somebody puts a gun to your head and says, "Be over the avodah zarah, I'm going to kill you," right? If you don't really believe that God is the ultimate metzias, right? He is the ultimate existence, and therefore your being killed is going to not hurt your existence, it's going to give you eternal existence. If you don't really, really feel that, it's going to be very difficult to give up your life for avodah zarah. So I believe in God, but you know, there's what's real and what I believe. This is, there's reality. Is it real to you or not? Right? The classic example I think we gave is, people can see a park bench that says wet paint, and they believe that the paint is wet, but when they touch it and look at their finger, they feel it even more. They experience it. It's real. So emunah is make it real. And then you can believe in something, but are you faithful to it? Are you consistent with it? Right? Are you willing to sacrifice for it? I believe it, but is it something that you're faithful to? And I believe in God. Do you believe that God is faithful? Can you trust him? Or do you have complaints when he does things that don't appear to be what you think he should be doing? So all of those things go into belief. So first you can fear God, but you can reach a level of vayaminu b'Hashem only after that. Not that I believe or not believe. That's taken for granted. But after I fear and stand in awe of the Rabbanu Shalom, then I really believe, meaning I see it, it's real to me, I'm willing to sacrifice, I'm willing to be faithful to it, I trust God. All of those things are much higher madregas. They come after Vayiru HaMes Hashem, and then really Vayaminu. Vayaminu doesn't mean I just believe it. It means that I believe it in a way that's significant. That's what real emunah is. That's the mitzvah of emunah, Anochi Hashem Lokecha, not just to believe in God. Because if you don't believe in God, God can't come to you and say, "Believe in me," because I don't believe you. Who said? But if I believe in God, now God can come and say, now take that belief and really enhance it and make it real. That's what real emunah is. Okay. I will see you in a few weeks, and you should have a lot of success on your midterms, and enjoy your vacation.